Get a kick when you click at chapelboro.com. Chapelboro.com, more of what you live here for. And now, welcome to The Art of Potential with your host, Kristen Heemstra, on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Hi, you are listening to Kristen Heemstra. The show is Art of Potential, and we are talking about all things career-related, including how to get educated, how to get hired, and how to find inspiration in your work. Right now, we are talking to Iasca Fernando, and he is the Assistant Director of Admissions for Yale University. We are talking about how to get admitted to an Ivy League school. And I know this is a particular interest to kids around the Chapel Hill area, many of whom have set their sights on going to the best institution they can. And so I ask her, can you give us some pointers on how can a student best present themselves to a school like Yale in hopes of being admitted?
I think the most important point is, is that they should actually be concise in what they sort of give to us. Because when you have 26,000 applications every single year and you're looking to admit about 1,900 students to yield a class of about 1,300 or so, you actually want students to present themselves in a concise manner but still give you as much information as they can. And there's this trend now in admissions. I think I've just seen this, students just repeating themselves over and over again in their application. And you'll see them talk about their big activity, let's say their president of mock trial. They speak about that on their common application, the little piece that they have to talk about. They'll sort of put it there. Then they'll attach a brag sheet and maybe give us a little bit more explanation. I think that's good. That's helpful. But then once the student starts to talk about it in their essay and starts to talk about it in their second essay and in their short answer, we're all human when we're reading applications behind it. So sort of my mind's going, okay, I get it. What else? What more is there behind this application? So what I'd like to see is some of the most mature students we see trust us to see what they have as their best strengths next to the admissions table, and they trust us to see it. They don't repeat it because the moment you start repeating, you dilute the entire message that you have in your application.
Instead of making it stronger, which is what they're trying to do.
Exactly. So hit it with a punch, one hard punch, and then add everything else because then guess what? You actually have more space to talk about yourself in other ways in your essays, and you can actually give us more information without using any more paper or any more space.
Okay. So I just have to ask you this because when I tell students, I get a lot of questions about essays, about how to present themselves about in an essay, about the topics to write upon. And I say what you're saying, which is they're human and they want an essay that has a voice to it, not necessarily an anthology of all the activities that you've had. And then students often feel like showing or writing their voice is a risk. Can you talk a little bit about some of the essays that you've seen and about what strikes you in a good essay?
Absolutely. You know, this is a question that I find, I'm going to spend a little bit of time discussing this. I find parents asking this question, students asking this question, and there are some misconceptions out there. So let's get those out of the way first. You find guidebooks telling you that your admission officer is sick and tired of reading application essays. It's 11:35 at night, and you've got to make or write something that jumps out of the page because if not, his or her application gets chucked out. Couldn't have been more wrong because, hey, I have a life too. I probably wouldn't be reading applications at 11:35 in the morning on a Friday night. And the next part is if I ever felt like I was sick and tired of reading applications, I'd sleep at that point. I wouldn't be sort of reading applications that late at night. Because what we're looking for in a college admissions essay, this is not a writing sample. This is an essay about yourself. We're looking for the application to be breathed some life into. You know, the essay should actually be breathing life into the application, putting a person behind all of the other stuff that we see. Because everything else can be sort of mechanical in terms of numbers, in terms of what the teachers say, so on and so forth. The teachers give us a little bit of a flavor for who the student is, but when you really write in your voice, that's what sort of brings it through. So on that note, the guidebooks out there are right. You actually have to have your voice in your essay. You absolutely do. There's no sort of risk in it because what then ends up happening is every year parents ask me, you know, what's the secret to getting in? I think if you write a good essay, you are in the mix. If you have everything else as well, you're in the mix to being very seriously considered for admission. Because what the essay should do is tell us who you are as a person. So the moment I read an essay, I should be able to construct in my mind what sort of person you are because I'm hearing your voice. And we're looking for the same person to come through in an entire application. The best possible thing you can do is to stay true to your voice. What do I mean by your voice, though? Because people tell you you've got to have your voice, but how? So the test that I sort of tell students, the little tip that I give them is to give that essay to a very good friend of theirs. Not your parents, they're sometimes biased, but you know, give it to a very good friend of theirs. Give them about 5 minutes to watch to read that essay. Watch them while they're reading that essay and ask them the question, does that sound like me? So for example, if my college roommate, who I'm very good friends with, if he gives me his essay, he's Josh, I'd probably be giggling and just grinning while I'm reading the essay and probably be telling him, dude, I can totally see you saying this, man. That's like, so you. That's the response you want from the person you give it to. Because chances are that matches up with what your teachers say, all of your extracurricular activities you're doing, all of your classes that you're taking. And the moment that happens, I don't know why, but the intangibles start working in the application. We're seeing the same person. That application raises itself to the top. So I think that's the best possible shot you can give yourself to sort of actually stand out amidst a pool of applicants by writing an essay that tells us something about you. Sometimes parents might think, students might think that these essay topics have to be big and fantastic and something very serious. Absolutely not. Some of the best essays I've read have been about how much family means to them. It can be about parents. It can be about a sibling. It can be about some personal incident, but something small. You don't necessarily have to write and tackle something major, something that's close to your heart, which tells us a little bit more about you that we couldn't probably glean from the other parts of the application.
Okay, so I just have to ask this because I have seen this. Can you tell when a parent's written the essay for the student?
Absolutely. It's sort of like a parent or an outside counselor or some outside help because it shows. And it's sort of like driving a car, you know. When you've driven a car and you've driven about 10,000, 20,000 miles, you know before you take that blind corner whether or not there's a car. It's the sixth sense. There's an intuition coming through. Same way when I read 2,500 application essays at least every single year, gotten about 5,000, 7,500 under my belt, have a very good sense of when the student's voice is not coming through versus when an adult writes it. It's really difficult to fabricate that. And sure, give it to someone to edit it, absolutely, because you don't want things like, you know, you don't want to say in your essay, I've been torturing students for 10 years when you wanted to say you were tutoring them, right? Because spell check doesn't necessarily catch that every single time. So give someone to sort of, give someone the essay to sort of proofread it. But apart from that, your voice, if it's your words, I mean, that's the best possible chance you can be giving yourself at being admitted.
Thank you. I think that is very helpful advice, particularly for a lot of our students, actually. So when you go to all these recruiting fairs at the private schools and at the public schools and things, what are some of the most common questions you get from students and what are some of the most common questions you get from parents?
Well, the common question I think that I get most of the time from parents is once they've sort of felt me out, as it were, they'd ask the question, well, what makes my son or daughter sort of stand out? Before that, they'll tell you what their son or daughter does for about 2 minutes or so. And then they'd say, well, he or she does X, Y, and Z. What is it that makes you stand out? And then sort of I tell them, I sort of give them, and I actually thought about this. I actually went back home and I said, well, what can I tell parents that actually makes sense to try to get them to understand we're actually trying to build a class at that point and not just looking, you know, trying to finagle sort of details and come up with a formula. Because truth be told, if we had a mechanical formula to admit students to Yale out of those 26,000 applications we get every year, we'd probably end up having to admit about 15, 16,000 of those students. So we can't really do that. So what I tell them is, listen, if there was a secret formula, I'd be selfish. I'd write a book about it and make millions of money. Being the Yale admissions admissions officer, people would sort of buy it.
Right.
But no, there are about 1,900 different stories to tell. And it's whatever you're doing, because we are trying to build a class, whatever you're doing. It's how do you do it? Do you do it with a passion? Do you actually like doing it? And when you come to a place like Yale and other schools on par with it, which have infinite resources, are you going to make the most out of the place? But that's sort of a typical question parents have. Then they'll also ask me about popular majors, what the campus life is like, what New Haven is like. Then students will sort of also ask me things about, you know, can I accelerate out of Yale? Can I double major? Can I triple major? You know,
Goodness.
Triple majors are not allowed at Yale. almost suicidal to think of triple majoring. But they come across as very intense, and they try to. I'm not sure how much of the questions are actually trying to impress versus actually trying to get
very
answers.
Interesting.
But for the most part, they'll want to know about the research opportunities, numbers of students getting into. I've noticed this, especially with the economy not doing too well in the past couple of years. What are the job opportunities like after Yale?
Yeah.
They'd want to know how many students get into med school, law school, business school. So those are sort of the typical questions I'd get.
What is the tuition at Yale right now?
I'm not exactly sure. Somewhere around the 30,000 range. The overall cost, I think, is $52,900. So $52,900 a year is it's a lot of money. But again, you know, we have the luxury of being one of the few schools in the U.S. Yeah. of being need blind, and also not just for the U.S. citizens, but for international students as well. So
comparatively, that's not a bad tuition right there. You and I were talking a little bit earlier, and if you wouldn't mind just sharing some of the, what is your admit rate for your applicant pool?
Sure. It's not something we're proud of particularly, because we'd love to admit more students. We have about 26,000 applications every year. We admit about 1,900 students to yield a class of about 1,300. That rate is about 7.5%.
So out of 100 applicants, 7.5% are getting admitted.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's why you're getting all the parents in particular very interested.
Absolutely.
In what is that X factor? And the X factor, I think you really hit the nail on the head when you were talking about it. It's an self-awareness and almost a self-leadership that a student has embraced and set a course on, starting their future a little bit in high school. And I assume that you all are looking at the application the same way you're looking at the transcript of past performance is going to be similar to future performance. Would you say that's the case?
That is the case, because that's what that's all we can actually go on, which is how have you done in high school?
Right.
In fact, how have you done in the most recent spate of time? So absolutely 9th grade, 10th grade, but what are the trends? How are you doing in 11th grade? Are you keeping up your work if you've been doing really well when you're taking a couple more AP classes? Or if not, if you just slacked off maybe a little bit in 9th grade, are you picking yourself up pretty fast come 10th, 11th grade? That's better. Of course, the best scenario is to do well throughout your high school career. We see a fair number of those students, but it's better to have that upward trend rather than actually slacking off in your 11th or 12th year.
Well, and then it strikes me that if you slacked off in your 9th grade year, those grades are averaged into your GPA, and your GPA then determines your rank. And if you slacked off your freshman year, your rank isn't going to be in the top 10% necessarily, in which case you probably aren't going to be coming through as strong as you would otherwise. Would you say that's, I mean, you probably don't know our system that well, but that would be the case.
Yeah. No, I'd say so. But also because at this point in time, it's such a holistic admissions process. I mean, I'm looking at that entire transcript. For example, if the school gives me rank 1 and the rank system out there is a complete soup, I mean, it's out of 4, it's out of 92, 107, it's unweighted, it's weighted.
Yeah.
I'm not going to waste my time trying to figure all of this out and come up with a standardized sort of way to measure this. What I would look at is if you say you're, you know, first in class, if your transcript says that, if you say you have a perfect 4.0, I'm like, good for you. Now I'm going to look at what classes you're taking and how well you're taking them and what the trends are there. So if you picked up a couple of B's in your 9th grade, but since then you're picking up the hard classes, you're taking the AP classes, and you're getting A's in those classes, clearly you're doing very well. You're a very capable student. So you are in the mix for Yale at that point.
Yeah. And then you'll also look at the SATs and the SAT2s or the ACT with writing, is that correct?
That's exactly right. So either the ACT with writing, that itself satisfies your testing, or the SAT1 with two SAT2 subject tests.
One question I get a lot is the SAT weighted higher than the ACT in the admissions process? And I consistently say no, but you can speak to that.
You are telling it absolutely right. No, we have no preference whatsoever. It sometimes is regional. I mean, students in certain areas tend to prefer the ACT over the SAT. We have no preference whatsoever.
Okay.
Either of those tests, it's just one small part of your entire Yale application. We just want to see the results of whichever the test is.
Okay. How would you say institutional goals are reflected in the admissions process?
Well, we do have, we are looking for the best scientists and the engineers to sort of consider Yale, because typically it tends to be that, you know, when you think of Yale, you think of a liberal arts school. When the sciences and engineering have been there for a while, I mean, the first engineering PhD was offered at Yale. The first PhD ever was offered at Yale as well. So Gibbs, if you're doing Gibbs's phase rule in physics and chemistry, he was the guy who got the first engineering PhD, and this was offered by Yale. So there's a very rich history and tradition associated with it, including a fair number of Nobel Prize winners, and most of the money that you sort of get from the National Health Institute, NIH funding, Institute of Health, I mean, all of that funding, you know, fair amount of that comes to Yale as well. But the word isn't out there. There's this lag in perception yet, I think. So we are looking for the best scientists and engineers. It is one of the goals of the university as well. And President Levin has pledged support for this. There's more than $500 million that has sort of been put towards this, which does not include any of the capital projects. So building new buildings, that's not part of the $500 million. It's not part of the sort of money.
So
that
where is the money going? I mean, $500 million is a lot to spend.
Yeah, so for labs, so brand new lab facilities that they'll sort of create or renovate. So most of Science Hill, all of the buildings are sort of going through a big renovation phase right now, hiring new faculty. That's a big thing.
Okay.
So getting the best sort of faculty to come to Yale, do research there, work with that. It's a fair amount of money going there. And also just creating new institutes within Yale in science and engineering to actually factor that. For example, this year we added on material science engineering as a major in engineering. So these take money, these take faculty, resources, efforts.
And it takes students.
It does take students as well.
There you go. Fabulous.
And then we're also looking for, in terms of institutional sort of priorities, the best students in underrepresented minorities in low-income families. We're always looking for these students because it is accessible. Yale is accessible to anyone. Financial aid is very generous. It's a need-blind school. So, you know, you applying for financial aid won't negatively affect your admissions decision in any way. It's not considered on our end. So because of that, we want the best and the brightest students and a diverse class of students to come to Yale and actually do well there.
In your incoming class, how many would you say are coming out of public schools and how many would you say are coming out of private schools?
We're about 55% public schools and 45% private schools right now.
And just out of curiosity, what are some of the funniest questions you've gotten over the years about admissions?
Oh, this is interesting. I've got to give a little bit of thought to this one. Funniest questions. Well, let's see. They'll sometimes ask me how, it was once the student who asked me, well, how many recommendations can I send extra, Mr.
That's
Fernando?
That's a great question.
And I said, well, don't break the record, which I believe was 26 in the office that we had. And no, the student wasn't admitted to Yale. So, you know, what can 26 recommenders tell you what two recommenders wouldn't about a 17 or an 18-year-old, right? And sometimes they'll ask me, well, how long can my resume be? I mean, is it okay if I actually fit in this and that and this and that onto this? Because I'm doing science research, so I'd like a letter from my mentor. But I also play piano and I'm doing violin and I want to include this and make sure I get this across. I say, you know, I've got to tell you, my resume isn't more than one page long. I mean, a single sheet, one page, one side, that's my resume. So I've also graduated from Yale. So there's a fair number of things I can put on that. But you've got to be selective, I say, because if you are a fantastic violin player, if you're a fantastic science researcher, what you do at the base level, your third grade prize in violin, you know, your eighth grade prize, it doesn't really matter. If you're an all-state musician at that level, that itself is good enough. Right. And it's maturity on your part just to give us that big number, because we assume automatically that if you are at that level, you had to pass through all of that to get there.
Right, and that's a good way to put it. So you put the crowning achievement, and you don't need to spell out all the other achievements you got to get you there.
Absolutely.
And which brings up an interesting question. One of the things that I've talked to students about to differentiate themselves is to put themselves out in high school in different competitions, and like the Siemens Science Competition, for example, or to in a writing competition or things like that. Is that something that influences an application?
Absolutely. It's a factor that we consider in our applications. What's funny was we actually have at Yale the Siemens Grand Prize winner from last year. It was in one of my areas. And what was funny was when we sort of go through this committee process in applications, we actually admitted him. We all decided we would admit him even before the Siemens results came. So the Siemens was just the icing on the cake. And at that point, we just said, well, this is great. We've already done the
right
thing.
Look how smart we are. See, we already knew that.
And we sort of got that through. But we do look at it, and it tells us a little bit about how serious the students are with their research. We've got the facilities at Yale for science research, for example. We've gotten 95% of the students doing research one-on-one with a professor at Yale in science or engineering.
That's
a fabulous number. We've got the facilities for students to do that. We want them to use it. So especially when a student has done research like this at a very significant level and they want to sort of continue with that research, we look at that. And this tells us that they've clearly been doing very good research. And at that point, we want to reach out to those students and say, well, you know, take a look at Yale as well at all of the research opportunities we'd have, because you could start at that point if you've actually dabbled and gotten your hands dirty in research, even as early as your freshman year, the moment you step onto campus during Bulldog Days, which is our admitted student program, if you are there on campus and you have a professor you want to work with, usually you set it up right there and you say, well, starting next semester, okay, the fall, when I actually come down, I'll be researching with you in your lab, sort of how it works.
Well, so let's say there's a student who's doing research and really has identified Yale as their key school and establishes some type of email relationship with that professor to the point where that professor is interested in having them come to Yale. Is there a benefit to the admissions process if someone at Yale writes a recommendation for the student who's trying to get admitted?
It can help, but here's how I would go about, for the student who's actually doing research, what I would sort of go about saying. If you are considering research at that point and you are at the level to discuss your research with a professor in terms of what he or she might be doing, because this is cutting edge research happening here at Yale, and you want to come across as smart with these professors when you're sort of chatting to them, if you do that, and you've also got to understand that they are very busy working with the undergraduates and sort of...
And that's their primary focus.
That is their primary
Absolutely.
Focus as well. What we'd like to really see is if you do have a paper written out, that's nice. If you have an abstract, that's okay as well. Together with that, what I'd really like to see and we'd like to see as an admissions committee is that letter that you get from your research mentor. Because at a high school level, you usually, very rarely would you just be doing your own project in your own laboratory. You'll be working in some big research lab. We'd like to see what your mentor says, because if you've published research, and you're not the only author. Usually on science papers, you get about 5 or 6 different authors. If you're the third author in that paper, but we want to know how much of work did you do to this? How much of this was actually your academic enterprise? What was your work ethic like in a lab? I mean, did you come? Did you actually jump into it? And that can only be told by a research mentor who's looking at you. So we'd really like to hear from your research mentor about the work that you're doing. So include a letter from your research mentor. This would actually be one of the places where it would make sense to include an additional letter of recommendation without just burdening the file with too much paper, because it will actually add to your application.
Okay, so let me ask you this then. Let's say that Yale is the number one school, choice school of a student, and it is for many of our students. And they have the means to do a summer program. Would it make sense for them to then go try to do a summer program at Yale in which they can have some type of experience with faculty members who are doing research?
Absolutely. And it again depends on a student. Some of our faculty members actually do like to have undergraduates, not undergraduates, but even sort of seniors and juniors at the high school level. Again, it depends on you completely, because it's on the student and the work they've done before. But if they wanted to reach out, it doesn't hurt to try.
Yeah.
Send an email out to a professor who's doing some significant research in an area that you really like.
Mm-hmm.
And if the professor does get back to you, well, then you've got something that's set up, which you can do. Some students around the area, if they can drive up, they do that, because then they don't actually have to live on campus or find separate housing. Because when you're a 17 or a 16-year-old trying to do research at this point, you'll have to find yourself a place to stay. And there are all sorts of considerations that parents might have. But if you have the means to do so and a professor says, okay, and you actually end up doing work with a professor over your summer in your junior year or senior year, I'd say freshman or sophomore year summer is a bit too early for that. But if you end up doing that in your junior year, certainly ask that professor to write a letter for you, just a note, drop it to the admissions office telling us about how you did the work. It'll help.
Yeah, no, that would make sense, because they have worked with you at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I ask her, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me. Is there anything else you would like to add before we wrap up?
No, thanks so much for having me. I think this is a pleasure. I'm glad I could make the time for it because I'm only spending about 2 days up here in the Durham Tropical Area. Yeah. But this has been fun. Thanks so much for having me and absolute pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Again, you are listening to Art of Potential. This is Kristen Heemstra and this is 1360 WCHL.
Visit chapelboro.com for more of what you live here for. And now, back to the Art of Potential with Kristen Heemstra on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
This is Kristen Heemstra, the Art of Potential. You are listening to 1360 WCHL. And we are talking about how to get admitted to an Ivy League school. Right now, we are going to talk to Taran Tadal. She is the Regional Director for Undergraduate Admissions at the University of Pennsylvania in beautiful Philadelphia. And she is going to talk to us about what happens in the application process. Welcome.
Thank you.
So if a student applies to University of Pennsylvania, and they're so excited because they've, I'm sure, been there and they've seen Philly and they've seen your campus is gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
And walked around that. First of all, what are some of the most common areas you see students applying to?
Okay.
What are some of the most common majors?
So the most common areas, at least from what I've seen in the last few years, has been anything law school related or medical school related.
Oh,
so everyone kind of feels like they're going to be a lawyer or a doctor, which is great. They have these great ambitions. Everyone says that they're pre-med, which is interesting because it's not a major necessarily, but
right.
It is a track.
Yeah.
So you'll see a lot of people doing kind of like the hyper bio. So biochemistry, biophysics. We have a major called biological basis of behavior, and it incorporates neuroscience, psychology, and biology, but it's integrated into one major. So the biologies are really popular. And then we're seeing a little bit of the traditional, like, history and poli sci, but I would say the natural sciences seem to be just really taking over, which is interesting to see.
That is, because when I think of you all, I think of Wharton. Like, just think of business.
Right.
And I don't know, and I didn't necessarily think of you all as a biology school.
So. Yeah, well, we're Research One University, so we're definitely known for our natural sciences, but you're so right, too. Wharton is definitely there, and we're pretty good at it, so business is definitely something that's popular as well.
Okay, so here I am. I've taken my hardest classes that I possibly could. I've done well in them, and I've taken the ACT. Mm-hmm. And do you all require SAT2s on top of ACTs?
We do not. So you can either do the ACT with writing test or the SAT with two subject tests. So if you've done the ACT with writing, you've done everything you need to for testing.
And your SAT2s, are they used for admissions or placement?
Typically, well, it does depend. There's one coordinated dual degree program that we have. It's a specialized program for international relations and business. That one, they do ask that you take an SAT2 in a language because that particular program, you have to be concentrating in a particular language. But other than that, you can take whichever one you want to. Typically, it's looked at in the evaluation process, and then it will help you for placement. So probably a little bit of both.
Okay. So when you evaluate the applications, I send in my packet, my teachers send in their recommendations, the college board sends in test scores or whatever, and then what happens?
So that's always a great question, I think, to ask any university or college that a student is looking at because even within the Ivy League, our processes are a little bit different. I would say overwhelmingly we use a committee process, so it's never just one person taking a look at your application and then it goes into like limbo. There definitely are people, checks and balances along the way. So at Penn, your application will go to a regional director, in this case, if you're coming from North Carolina, especially Chapel Hill area, it'll go directly to me.
Okay.
We read everything online now, so it helps the process go just a little bit quicker than when we used to have paper applications. So I take a look at the application. My job really is to look for ways to admit you. Look for all of the details about your community, how you challenge yourself within your curriculum. So yep. If you're taking the most challenging courses, what does that mean for your school? Not necessarily for the competing schools or even the other students in your school. So we look at how you challenge yourself in the curriculum. We'll look at your GPA, how it stands on the transcript. We won't recalculate. And I'm looking through all of the pieces of the application essentially to write a review about the application. So when I do that, and for Penn, you apply directly into a specific school, one of the four schools that we have, whereas like Harvard, for example, you're just applying to Harvard directly. But for us, the school that you apply into dictates what committee I will then present you to. So if, for example, you're applying to Wharton School of Business, mm-hmm. I will prep your file as a Wharton applicant, and then I will take your application to the Wharton committee. So there will be, it's anywhere from 6 to 10 people who will be in the room.
Okay, what do they look like? Because I have this picture of dark paneled walls.
I can understand that. Yes.
Suits and ties.
Yes. It's so not that. So when I'm alone reading my application, it's very swanky. It's me in my pajamas eating berry cakes until I can't stand it anymore and sitting reading from November to March. And then committee typically happens towards the end of each cycle. So November 1st is our deadline for early decision. I'll do the reading in the beginning, and then late November into December we'll go into committee. Everyone will go into sessions of committee. Same thing for regular decision, deadline's January 1st, and then we will look at applications probably, I would say, around mid to late February into March. So when I walk into the committee room, it is the long conference table. Okay. There is no wood paneling. Our conference rooms, unfortunately, are not that swanky, kind of older, dark carpet. People come in jeans and hoodies, and they have breakfast sandwiches from Starbucks. And they
a hoodie and jeans, I'm sorry, it's just not rolling with Wharton for me.
I know. How interesting is that? But yeah, people come in very casual.
Yep.
Just downright casual, because it's a long process. Yep. We will sit in that room for however long it takes to get through a particular set. So typically we try to do about 150 applicants if we can in a sitting. And so that can be a very long process.
So that's 8, 9, 10 hours?
It could potentially be. Yeah. And we'll take breaks and things like that. We'll bring junk food. We'll do all of that. But it's a long process.
Okay. So like if you're doing, and I'm not good at math, but let's say you're doing every hour, you've got to do then 10, 12 applications?
I would say probably about 10. We'll try to do about 10, but again, it's difficult to gauge because you might have a longer conversation about one applicant versus the other. And I'm bringing all the applicants, which is, yeah. So,
Some of them might be real quick conversations.
Right. Some of them could potentially say, quite sure. Yes, the pace of it, maybe about 10 an hour. But remember, I've prepped everything. So they have the big quick points that are there.
Okay.
And then it's my job to sit. So I'll walk in and sit, not necessarily the head of the table, but kind of to the side of the head of the table. It'll be, sometimes professors, sometimes the dean from Wharton is there. Academic advisors are always there because they've seen kind of the long-term successes of high school students coming in and them kind of on the back end, what actually happens when they're in the school. So they will be always be there because they have a great voice and a great perspective about what's happening with the students and their actual success. That's what all of us are looking for, is students that we can take and who can be successful. We don't want to set students up for failure.
Yeah.
So I will sit, to the side of the head of the table. I'll have one admissions colleague who's my second chair, and then the chair of the committee. So the chair of the committee could be the dean of admissions, could be the vice dean or associate dean. We have a couple of them. So three vice deans, two associate deans, plus the dean. So there's there's a chair in every single one. And so the chair will say, okay, who do we have up? And I just start, I name the name, I name the high school, I give all the gory nitty gritty details, and then people will start to ask me questions. So they'll ask me anything from, you know, I noticed the student took calculus AB instead of BC. Does the high school have BC? Why didn't they take BC? Things like that. And so it's my business to get as much nitty gritty detail as I can to shoot back and say, oh, well, the student was taking this because the schedule didn't fit or whatever the case may be for that student.
Now, I'm really glad to know that because sometimes it's difficult to counsel a student the best way and what math to take because you don't necessarily know.
No.
So let me ask you this. If you have someone coming in for business, do you want to see them on the calculus track or the stat track, or does it matter? Because we have both.
That's a great, great question. We want to see students on the calculus track.
Okay.
Typically, students who have experience in calculus, and this is actually coming from the academic advisors, they tend to be more successful in their first year than students that have not had exposure to calculus.
Well, I had no idea. I'm so glad you're here.
I know. I'm so glad to be able to tell you. And I do think that we should do a better job of kind of putting that out there, putting that information on the websites. But yes, for business, certainly calculus is very helpful. I would say across the board, though, many of the majors that you would look at for Penn, probably with the exception of, you know, theater arts and visual arts and things like that, calculus is a really big factor.
Okay. Right?
Yeah, which is interesting.
Well, let me ask you this. When you look at, like, the APs and the histories, do you look for APUSH, APUS more than you look for AP Gov or AP Euro or anything like that? Or are those kind of weighted all the same?
I think those are weighted pretty equally. Okay. But if a student is really into history, if they've taken a variety of like AP history courses, if they even have that at their school, that's always an awesome reinforcement of their interest in that particular major.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I just didn't know because of I'm just learning so much.
Oh, it's good, though. It's good. I'm glad to be able to help.
So if a kid is interested in sciences, like for the physics, you'd want to see physics C if it were offered as opposed to physics B to show their level of interest.
Of interest, yes, if they can. And I do understand there are definitely moments when, you know, scheduling just can't happen.
Or it does absolutely happen
that
way.
Totally. Or in some cases, you don't have a professor, enough people to, you know, have the class, and therefore the student can't have it. So we understand those pieces.
You do if they're explained, but if they're not explained.
So true. So true.
Then you really wouldn't know. So that is something that students need to explain. And guidance counselors, I think, also need to take a moment to explain.
Put that in the letter, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And for students, so we use the comment application, which is so helpful because students are looking at it anyway. The additional comment section is always really helpful if there's something they feel they need to explain. So I always encourage students to at least look at that section and then add a few notes if there are things they feel need to be explained on the application.
And a lot of times there are. I'm just thinking, like, we went from having an AP language class to making it a different, I think we made it level 5.
Oh.
Which, where it impacts the student is they can't take the AP now, but they also can't get the points, and the points impact the rank.
And
that would be
something good to know,
right, when you're going through. Now, how important is rank in your decision making?
It does not make or break the overall transcript. The overall transcript is definitely going to weigh more. The rank is just, it typically adds stars to the, you know, the accolades of the student, but doesn't necessarily detract, because we understand that for rank, sometimes you might have a student who kind of snuck in there who may not have taken such a challenging course load. So we understand all of those things happen. So really, rank is there to kind of look at the overall class, but not, by no means are you judged strictly on rank.
Okay, so now I have a better picture of you in your pajamas eating. What are you eating again?
Berry Kicks is typically my food of choice.
Berry Kicks?
Yes.
Okay, so there you are. You've got your bowl, and you're scrolling through essays. And it's got to be, I mean, I would think, how many essays, how many applications do you typically have to read through?
In a day? My aim, it does depend on my overall numbers, but I'll anywhere from 25 to 30 applications. I'll try to read in one day.
Okay, so you're, let's say, doing an 8-hour day, probably more like a 10, but we'll just say 8 so that your brain doesn't fry. And so you're doing 3 to 4 an hour. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, I'd say about 4. An hour. Okay. Yeah.
So, and the kids have obviously spent hours and hours preparing this for you to look at. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at the application for a solid 20 minutes then. Mm-hmm. And so you're really reading and looking over that. So there's got to be some essays that have just inspired you and some that have maybe not.
Not so much inspired. Yes. I would say yes to both. And I think my colleagues would agree in other schools. Yes. So I always tell the students I'm a nosy person. That's why I do this job.
Yeah.
So in the application, I'm really looking to find out more about the student and their experience because they're the only ones who can explain what's happened in their life and what's brought them to this point. So essays, we always say, and I've heard other people in admissions say this too, is we always say to stay away from hot topics. So hot topics could be politics, war, healthcare, the BP oil spill. It could be these broader issues that are kind of addressed in the news. They don't necessarily need to address that in the essay. So I would say essays that I've read where a student is talking about maybe an environmental issue or a political issue that they're not necessarily attached to in any way, it becomes problematic because I know that the student is intelligent and they very much have made their argument. Like, say it's a persuasive essay. Right. They very much made their argument and they've articulated themselves well, but I have no new information about that student.
About that person.
I don't know who that person is. I just know that they're smart and that they write a good essay. So I always encourage students to really talk about themselves and their personal experiences. And I do think that the essay questions in the Common application hopefully help students kind of guide them in that direction of talk about yourself. This is totally a time to brag. I always tell students that too. So tell us your story. And it could be really minute details. For example, I read an essay where a young lady was talking about, I initially thought she was talking about her boyfriend. So the essay talks about, you know, how this person is always so supportive of her. And, you know, when she gets off of the lacrosse field, you know, there he is. And, you know, she takes long drives with him and so dependable and things like that. At the end of the essay, it was her old beat up Volvo that she was talking about. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so creative. But, you know, I got to know about her life and I got to find out more about her and her personality.
Yes,
exactly. And I'm like, at the time I had a Volvo too, so that was very cool. And I was like, yes, this is awesome. So it was just a chance for me to know more about her. She was able to kind of show her personality a little bit and she didn't have to talk about these big major issues that, yes, are very important, but not necessarily important for the college essay.
I tell when I'm talking with kids, they say, you know, the people in the admissions office are you just a little older. So you've got to write an essay you would actually like to read.
It's true. If you're curled up on the couch, what would you like to read?
Right, exactly.
And that's really what it is, because we are sitting there and we're putting in long days and most of us probably have glasses now, even though we didn't start out that way. And we want to know more about you. That's why we do what we do. We're looking overall. I think what really kind of mixes people up is that we are really looking for a fit for each one of our schools. Each one of our schools has a different personality and different reasons why people are attracted to our schools. So that's why you'll see on the back end when we have, you know, our incoming freshmen, they'll talk about how they got into Duke and Harvard and MIT and Penn, but they didn't get into Princeton. Or they got into Princeton and Harvard and Penn, but they didn't get into Yale. Or, you know, people will call us up and say, you know, I didn't get into Penn, but I did get into Duke, MIT, and Berkeley. You know, and it's, first off, that's fantastic. I love the fact that, you know, our students have so many different options.
Right.
We are really looking for a fit, and sometimes the fit is totally there, and it's so unmarked that you can't even help yourself. To other points where students just, you look at them and you say, oh my gosh, they'd be perfect for such and such school.
Right.
And so that's why you'll have sometimes people will look at the statistics and they'll look at numbers and they'll say, okay, you have to have such and such score to get into this particular school. And really, it ends up being us kind of merging our mission that's coming from the president or the dean or something like that, and really merging it with the personalities that we find in the applications and try to make decisions from there.
And that's one thing that I've learned in doing this is that the school's mission really does trickle right on down to admissions.
It's amazing.
And I didn't realize quite how strong that connection was. It makes sense, and it's so obvious that you go, duh. But
right, but you just, when you're in the thick of it, that's the last thing you're thinking about. Because I remember applying to colleges and not, it didn't even dawn on me that, oh, there should be a connection and a personality fit and things like that. It's clear now, like you said, but at that point in time, I was just thinking about, where can I get in?
Right, and I
need to go to college, but parents say I have to go. So you figure it out.
Okay, so how many, what's your percentage, how many students do you accept that apply?
So percentage of acceptance for early decision, which for us is a binding contract, and that's typically about 30 to 35% acceptance.
Okay.
And we have, I would say.
So one in three, roughly.
Roughly, yeah. Exactly. And then for regular decision, this past year, it was about 14%. But students hear this and I could see the like color just drain from their faces when I say that, because I think they assume, oh no, we can't, there's no chance I'm going to get in. And before students get encouraged, I always say to them, when we give you these acceptance numbers, you have to know what our ultimate goal is. So each school has to enroll a certain number of freshmen every year to maintain the class size and, you know, just all the other fancy statistics that we give you. So at Penn, we're aiming to get about 2,500 students in every year because we have 10,000 undergraduate students. So about 30% of the 2,500 that physically walk onto campus are coming in through early decision.
Okay.
So in reality, we have another 70% that we need to bring to campus.
Yeah.
So we have to also enroll more, we have to accept more students to enroll 2,500. Okay. So in order to get that yield, we have to accept more in regular decision. And so students hear the 14%, but they're also not thinking, oh, there are a ton of applications, and we also have to accept many because we need to yield a certain number by the fall. So I just put that out there. So students feel a little bit better when they hear other schools have these kind of low acceptance numbers. Don't rule yourself out of the game. The only way to guarantee that you're not going to get into a particular school is to not apply.
And I concur with that wholeheartedly. I do concur, but I do need to say sometimes if you're not even in the ballpark, I know it's your job to encourage people to apply, and I know you would never tell anyone to apply to a particular school, but if you're coming in at the bottom 75% of your class and your SAT scores or ACT score standardized testing is low, unless you have an incredible story and you have,
I have seen some of
those incredible stories, you're like, wow.
It tugs at our heartstrings, those stories.
They do, but if you don't have an incredible story, sometimes you're better off just saving your money.
This is true. This is very true.
For other things.
So true.
And I think that is a great message to end on, because it is one of those things where you need people to understand you're sending your child off to college, and if they can't do the application by themselves, you are sending a big chunk of money often with them.
Yes.
It's a good testing point.
It is.
To make sure you're not sending your money down the wrong pipeline.
Exactly, because you don't want them to come back and be frustrated and be unhappy with their decision. And a lot of it was influence from the outside and not theirs. But I do have to say, I totally commend you in the work that you do, because we don't see a certain side and that whole application and the anxiety and the picking of the schools and all of that. I totally appreciate just all the work that you do, because I'm not sure if I could do it. It takes a lot of patience.
Yes. No.
Yeah. And counseling. A lot of appointments outside of school to get it together. So I very much appreciate the work that you do as well.
Thank you. And thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
My pleasure.
Again, this is Tehran Tadal. She is the Regional Director of Undergraduate Admissions from the University of Pennsylvania. And you are listening to 1360 WCHL. This is Kristen Heemstra with the Art of Potential.